Make sure to check out season 1 of Talking Shape, interviews and insights into the Halloween franchise, including former HalloweenMovies.com webmaster Anthony Massey.
When Freddy vs. Jason came out, Mustafa called me on my phone, and I was like, holy, the man never called me. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he said, I was just on the phone with Dimension, and he said, they want to pit Michael against Pinhead, and I feel like that's the worst thing to do, and I want to prove them wrong. Can you put a poll up on the website and ask the fans?
Sandy Johnson, who played Judith Myers in the original Halloween 1978.
Blumhouse. They were looking for me because they wanted to use that footage in the cemetery. But in order to do that, they had to have me sign off on it. Well, of course, I'd been missing for 40 years. Nobody knew where I was, and I didn't know anybody cared. And so they were able to get my signature so that I could be in it again.
And Daniel Farrens, the writer of Halloween 6.
And the one thing I remember saying to him in that meeting was, it's Rosemary's Baby meets Halloween. That was like the kind of elevator pitch tagline that I said out loud. And his eyes just kind of grew wide. It was almost like, you know, in interviews, and this all happened later, all these interviews that I saw, you know, different documentaries on Halloween. But I remember Mustafa saying then, like, oh, the reason I greenlit Halloween, the original in 78, was that John Carpenter came in to me with a very simple pitch. The boogeyman murders babysitters on Halloween. And he understood that. So when I said Rosemary's Baby meets Halloween, he understood that. It was a simple concept that he grasped it right away. Go and write a treatment. Come back to us in a week. If we like it, we'll go to the next step.
Talking Shape Season 1. Now available wherever you stream your podcasts.
Jed, are you...
Death has come to your little town. Do you know what Haddonfield is? Families. Children all lined up in rows up and down these streets. You're telling me they're lined up for a slaughterhouse? They could be.
For over 40 years, the Halloween series has thrilled and terrified audiences. From its low-budget origins to spawning a new era of slashers, the franchise remains a cultural touchstone around the world, often referred to as the Gone with the Wind of horror. From the first chilling notes of the iconic score to the final frame, join Joel Brown as we explore the iconic horror series, digging deep into the characters, the storylines, and the spine-chilling scares. Welcome to Talking Shape with Joel Brown, the ultimate podcast for Halloween franchise enthusiasts.
Deborah Hill, often hailed as the godmother of indie filmmaking, defied convention and blazed a trail in an industry entrenched in tradition. Despite her name not being as widely celebrated as some of her contemporaries, her impact on filmmaking is profound and far-reaching, evident in her groundbreaking collaborations with the likes of John Carpenter and Linda Obst. My next guests, Irish filmmakers Jim McMorrow and Margaret McGoldrick, the creative minds behind the highly anticipated documentary, working title at the moment, Hollywood Trailblazer, The Deborah Hill Story. Hello and welcome, Margaret and Jim.
Hi, thank you.
Nice to be here, thank you.
And just for our listeners, Margaret and Jim, if you can give us a background on yourself. You guys are both producers, filmmakers, but I'll start off with you, Jim. Bit of a background, how did you get into producing filmmaking?
I met Margaret on a feature film. I've been a lifelong film fan, but I didn't really get an opportunity to make anything until about 10 years ago, which was an independent feature film called Braxton. I believe the American title is The Butchering. I met Margaret on that. Margaret was producing it. I kind of did a variety of jobs. I was the co-composer and associate producer, and Margaret and I just kind of became friends ever since, and Margaret's been my Deborah Hill for several shorts, and just been a real great friend and soundboard for me. So yeah, in the last 10 years, I've made a handful of shorts and been lucky enough to be on this documentary now.
And now what about yourself there, Margaret? Have you got as glowing references for Jim as he does for you?
What he left out is that he was scared of meeting me when we were working on Braxton for the first time, which I still don't understand. Whatever fear he had was unfounded because we did become such good friends. Yeah, no, so I was just making really a handful of shorts, had no real intention of producing as such. It was more friends of myself and Jim's were just writing good scripts and they were directing them and we were going, oh, well, let's just make it. And you sort of became a default producer. I met Jim on Braxton and he had impressed us so much because we then, I was producing a mini series. It was a crime web series called Far for RTE, which is an Irish broadcaster here, which Jim got roped into scoring on that as well. Jim takes inspiration from John Carpenter, as you can tell, a filmmaker of many, many skills and talents. And then, yeah, we've kind of collaborated on and off over the years, helping each other on various projects. I produced and directed a short called The Hangman a few years ago. It was just an unfunded thing that I'd written and decided to make. And Jim also came on board and helped me out in post with that and did like a really incredible score and sound mix. So, you know, we've kind of been like working with each other on and off in various ways for quite a bit. And then in between having movie and pizza nights at Jim's apartment, it all kind of built to this when Jim penned an essay. I can't, I'll let you jump in and like, you can fill in as to where it came from, because I think it was a call something, but you penned an essay on Deborah Hill and sent it to me. And I just remember reading it going, it's really weird, this isn't a documentary. To which Jim had pointed out, well, someone had started to make one, but it seems to have petered off. There's nothing happening. And then I was like, well, if it's not happening, if it's definitely finished, or it's not being completed, would you mind if I went to Northern Ireland Screen? And so just trying to see if maybe they'll support some development on this and see if we could have a go. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, I mean, we exchange copious amounts of Christmas presents every year, and one of the presents that Margaret's boyfriend Aidan bought me was a local compilation of film essays, and I was like, oh wow, I didn't know this was out there, and I kind of said, I mean, over the years, I think it's pretty evident from my wall behind me, if you want to be part of my life, you gotta have Halloween in it. It's just my thing. So when you know, Margaret would be over and I would be constantly sort of saying like, oh, you know, Deborah Hill did this, Deborah Hill did that, and then when this like book came along, I kind of thought, well, I could write something for this is interesting. And Margaret was like, oh yeah, let me read that. That would be interesting. So I would like forward her chapters as time went on, and the more and more I was going on, Margaret was just like, you know, this should be a documentary. And I would just never dare to dream that big. You know, I'm a very small town in a lot of ways. Was Margaret was just like, no, you could definitely, this could definitely work. And she went to Northern Ireland Screen and she said, nay, give us some development funding for research, which was like the stupidest thing ever, because like I've been researching this my whole life, you know, this is like since I watched Halloween, this is easy. And it's been one of those sort of pieces. I don't think filmmaking's kind of hard, you know, it's a grind on a day-to-day basis, but this has been one of those projects where just essentially everybody has just said yes. And I think it's testament to Deborah, basically, that people are just like, either A, it's an incredibly interesting and relevant story, or B, yes, I knew her and I'm willing to do anything to honor her legacy. So it's just been really great for us.
We're talking off air that there doesn't seem to be a great abundance of information about Deborah Hill, the person. Obviously, you said there's her filmography and all that, you can find that stuff, but not so much about Deborah Hill the person, why do you feel there hasn't been like this type of documentary done previously? Or they've tried to do once, but they haven't been fizzled out, so to speak.
I mean, the thing is, it is really tricky starting a documentary and not having access to the main contributor, but not having access to much even in the way of archive. You know, people have been saying to us, well, what is the story that you're trying to tell? And we're like, well, it's Deborah. And we're getting really interesting and sometimes funny and quirky aspects of her personality that we can analyze, or we can learn more about through the body of her work, things that she took on, and you know, the fights that she was willing to take on, and the challenges. But for us, I mean, it kind of started with the fact that, you know, she broke through with Halloween. That was the '70s. You just don't break through as a female producer. It's unheard of. I mean, she was mistaken for, you know, the trainees, and then more than once. But she knew it, but she wasn't for letting it stop her. And I think 2023, now 2024, you know, there's been the last few years, there's been a cry for more diverse talent in front of the camera and behind off screen. But you know, that's also give credence to those who are doing that decades and decades before now, who were kind of, as so many people have literally said without any prompt or quote, like from myself or Jim, breaking the glass ceiling. You know, we did an interview last week and someone literally said that to us in the interview, and I was just like, this is what everyone thinks of Deborah, you know, this. So that in itself is kind of like why it's worthwhile telling the story. But also it's just super interesting when you listen. You know, Deborah was a passionate activist and a huge environmentalist, and I'm always telling our interviewees that, you know, when I'm going for funding, environmentalism, for example, is something that is built into my contract now. I have to factor as a producer with my productions. Deborah was on this from the 80s. You know, she was doing it without prompt. She just knew what was important. And so she was just very ahead of her time. And I think that in itself makes for a really interesting documentary.
The other thing about it is she was so far reaching. So it's interesting. It's been interesting for us to, you know, to go from someone, you know, who's not available to who's not there, who's no longer with us. But she was so far reaching and touched so many lives that so many people have stories about her, to the point where now we're kind of thinking, okay, we've really got to cut this off. We really got to stop our interviews at some point, because we could go on forever. You know, even we had a lovely Zoom with another Australian native, Jamie Blanks, who, you know, really credits Deborah with, you know, progressing his career and, you know, really getting him into the DGA and so forth. And stories like that are just endless. And that's kind of where all our information's coming from, because everybody who she touched has a story to tell. And it's just about whether we can fit them in our own time.
Now, Jim, you said earlier that, you know, in order to have a relationship, or would that be a friendship, they have to love Halloween. So I'm going to assume, Margaret, that you love Halloween. I mean, I can tell straight away, obviously, Jim, with the masks and all that in the background. I can also see the Donnie Darko evil bunny, or the guy dressed up as a bunny.
Good day.
Lot of the great stuff in the background there, but obviously a bit of a contrast with your walls there, Margaret. We've got the Breakfast Club, which is an 80s classic, When Harry Met Sally, another great rom-com. Margaret, are you as obsessed, I guess, as with Halloween as I am and Jim seem to be?
I don't think anyone is as obsessed as Jim, I'm going to be completely honest with that one. I was traumatized by horror movies when I was like 4 years old. Actually, this is a testament to what I think of Jim, because I saw Nightmare on Elm Street when I was four, and I was convinced every night that Freddy was coming to get me, and that really killed my relationship with horror, except for some reason Scream, because I adore the Scream franchise. And then one of Jim's shorts a few years ago was playing ahead of a screening of Nightmare on Elm Street, and I got over myself to support my friend, which I really did not want to do. Halloween, I think has, I guess I think of it in many ways closer to like, it's kind of the original slasher in so many ways. And like, I love the mystery side of slashers. I think that's what it is. You know, Halloween is like, it's such a fun one to sit down and watch. And as I say, like, we've done so many movie nights at gyms, you know, there's a crowd of us and we'll all go over and hang every Christmas Eve. There's three of us go to myself, my boyfriend, and his cousin or one of our best friends go to gyms on Christmas Eve, and we usually have a choice of a horror related Christmas themed movie. You know, like, that's, it's very much, you know, if you're in gym circle, that's the way. But they're always good fun, so they are. So and we've had some pretty hilarious midnight screenings. Especially actually the Halloween 2018, that was good fun. At one of our local cinemas, you know, people dressed up as Michael Myers jumping out at every corner. So yeah, no, it has been fun, but I don't think anyone, I mean, just look at that background. Nobody is there with Jim except for Jim.
it's a bit like in A Clockwork Orange, you know, when the vitiligo technique, when the hook's in the eyes, that's kind of, you know, Margaret doesn't remember that, but that definitely happened.
I remember.
I don't want to get too off track here. Obviously, I think Miramax bought the rights, whether it be for the movie or a potential TV series. As creatives, producers, filmmakers, where do you see the franchise moving forward?
That's a really great. I mean, I've heard the rumors about the television show. I know. I mean, there's been some interesting comics around sort of our early years in Smith's Grove and so forth. I'll be there for Halloween no matter what anyway. But I think, you know, when you kind of look at the comic books and you look at the novelization of Halloween, and there were these sort of odd little stories in it, I think that's kind of an interesting way to go. And in the novelization, I believe, of Halloween Ends, there were all these sort of stories where Michael would just be out of his cell. He'd have gotten out, and, you know, nobody knew how he was getting out. And maybe certain things had happened around Smith's Grove, but they couldn't prove it was him, but they just knew it was him. I kind of find that interesting, you know. But I'll be there no matter what. It's all good.
Yeah, I'm 1,000% saying, like, it could be, yeah, Michael in space or something like that. And I, like, as a Halloween fan, I'll watch it. Whether it be any good, you know, that remains to be seen. But yeah, speaking of the original, I mean, that was the career launch for Jamie Lee Curtis, who I believe is executive producing this documentary. Now, I say this in jest. What does that mean? What is she doing? What is she doing? Is she putting her name to all your hard work?
No. We interviewed, Jimmy was one of our first interviews. And that was a real, it was great for us, because I think the consistent question we've been asked, and it's been with sincerity, not with distrust, is like, why you two from Ireland? Like, what is the connection here? And everyone's just a bit surprised. It's like, who are these random filmmakers who've decided to make a movie about our best friend? So having Jamie sit down and give us our time, I think is a bit of a sign of trust. It's like, okay, these people can be, you know, maybe they're a bit more trustworthy, or they sort of maybe know what they're at. We had done very little interviews when Jamie came on board. It was our exec producer, Kerry Deneen Roy, had reached out to Jamie in the first place. And yeah, we met up with her. We went out to LA. We set up a bunch of interviews, including lots of David Gordon Green and Stacey Scher and Linda Ops. And yeah, Jamie just, she sat down with us and told us stories about not just Halloween, but actually it was kind of more her relationship and her friendship with Deborah, which was quite lovely.
It was a dream come true. I mean, it was kind of one of those things that, being such a fan, you kind of just assumed would fall apart. And when we got a yes, I literally did a cartwheel. I was so happy. And when we got to LA, it was just kind of one of those things where it was just like, she'll cancel. She will cancel. And I remember we filmed her interview in the Aero Cinema in Santa Monica, and we, which is again in Donnie Darko, which is cool for me, but we were just waiting. We had all the cameras set up, and we were like, "Well, she will cancel. There's still time to cancel." And Margaret got a phone call, and I just saw Margaret go like, "Hello, oh, hello, right." Okay. And she hung up and she's like, "Jamie's 5 minutes out." "Who was that?" "That was Jamie." And I was like, "What? Are you kidding me?" I thought it would be this kind of crazy entourage of people that would be like, "Right, okay, she will sit here. She will be mic'd from here or whatever." Jamie walked into the theater alone. You know, she just kind of popped in, and she was talking to the cinema owner about, I think they were doing a screening of Everything Everywhere All at Once. And when she came in, she said to the guy, "Here, can I come down like ahead of time and just sort of meet people, meet the fans?" And he said, "Like, yeah, that'd be cool." And she was like, "Oh, I've got a better idea. Can I serve popcorn? Can I have a name tag?" And the guy was like, "Yeah, I guess." And so it kind of started off like that. We had this lovely interview. And then right at the end of it, she said, "So, you know, who are you guys interviewing while you're out here?" And we said, "Oh, you know, David Gordon Green and Stacey Scherr and Linda Obst." And she said, "Okay, well, okay, who do you want to interview?" And we said, like, "I don't know." We didn't really kind of have an answer. And she was like, "Have you spoke to John?" And we said, "No, we can't get in touch with him." She's like, "Hold on." And she just took out her phone and dialed and was like, "You know, John, Jamie Lee Curtis, got these Irish filmmakers here. I'm going to give you their details, blah, blah, blah." And she just kind of hung up like, "Who else?" And that's kind of, you know, that was kind of, again, one of those sort of moments where you were like, wow, you know, this legitimized us a hell of a lot more than just being two fans, you know, from Ireland. This really gave us credence and context. And it's kind of, again, as I say, it's been like that across the board. You know, like Stacey, sure, has just been incredible and supportive and was like, "You know, have you interviewed this person? There's his email address, you know, reach out." And Bob, Deborah's brother, has been incredible. He's gifted us so many sort of things from Deborah's estate. I have an original Fog poster in my living room now, you know, which is incredible. And he gave us a bunch of scanned in like 8mm films from their childhood back in the 50s. So that type of archive is completely unique and invaluable, and it's just been amazing for us.
That's an amazing story. I mean, because, you know, all the, you know, rumors and innuendo that you hear about, you know, celebrities being, you know, too big or too good for things, and just to hear that type of story is amazing. I was told by James Jude Courtney that Jamie Lee Curtis, she doesn't suffer fools gladly. And I kind of feel potentially that's maybe something she learned from Deborah Hill. I feel like Deborah Hill would have been a not suffering fools gladly type of person.
I think Jamie's kind of, it's weird. She's kind of been thrusted in that scream queen, you know, status is something that, you know, myself and all have been kind of, we thrust upon her, but in reality, she's actually really funny and like sarcastic and witty. And, you know, she's told us kind of that's what Deborah was like, and that's kind of what they, you know, that's kind of the shared humor that they bonded over. And it was so funny. I mean, like, this is literally a dream come true for me. And I remember Margaret, before we would go on certain Zooms, she would say, "Listen, you got to be professional here." And I was like, yeah, totally. I'm definitely a professional, 100%. I'm pro. And I remember, like, Jamie was one of those ones where it was like, okay, focus, yeah, we're focused up, yeah, make lights perfect, yeah, good. Really, really professional. And then as soon as we cut cameras, I was just, "Oh my God, I love you. Would you sign my Halloween theme book?" You know, I just dropped character. And I think, you know, I'm kind of worried whether maybe that would be something that would make her go, "Oh God, you know, I was wrong." But she's just been lovely ever since, so it's been great.
The nurturing of talent, I guess you could kind of say, like, Jamie would kind of come under that umbrella with Deborah Hill. And I only just found out that James Cameron worked as a visual effects guy for a film that Deborah Hill was working on. you just mentioned fellow Aussie Jamie Blanks, director of Urban Legend and Valentine fame. What was it all? What stories have you sort of begin to find out for this sort of nurturing of young talent or up and coming talent? Like she had an eye for it, I guess, or like she would see young, she see herself in these young filmmakers and help them out?
She really believed, I think, in giving people their shot. I mean, one of the reasons that Deborah got Halloween as a producer was because John Carpenter said he wanted his girlfriend to produce, you know, like, but Deborah proved herself. I mean, because I know, especially recently, there's been like the whole nepotism argument, but anyone we spoke to who worked on that said that Deborah was over it. So I think, if anything, it was back then, it was a testament to John knew that she was more than capable. Deborah, I think, was similar in many ways when she was came to working with other people. She knew when someone was capable and someone had a good mindset. We've spoke with Jeffrey Chernoff, for example, and Jeffrey is a UPM exec producer working on major Hollywood blockbusters. And he worked with Deborah. Jim, was it Halloween 2?
Halloween 2, yeah.
Yeah. And she basically said, I think I'd have to go back and revisit, but I think he was a second AD. And she said, what do you want to do? And he said he wanted to produce. And when it came to doing Clue, she basically said, right, you're the production manager. And that's a huge jump. That pretty much, I don't know anyone who would do that sort of jump today even, or who would allow it. But I think the case was, it was, you know, she wasn't making it easy for you. It was your job to make this happen and to pull this off and to prove your worth, but she was absolutely willing to give you that shot. The same with Kim Gottlieb Walker on Halloween. She really fought for Kim. That was her breakthrough, I think, as a feature. She was, you know, an established photographer, but I think she was doing more. She'd been doing, like, it wasn't just films in particular. So she didn't have like union card or anything like that. So Deborah basically just saw her talent and was like, this is the right person. And John trusted her in that as well. So you can see like a scattering of this over the years. Stacey Scher is another one. I think Stacey was the one who found the script Adventures in Babysitting when she was working with Deborah and Linda, and took it to them. And they were like, yeah, this is great. There's isn't it the saying, you know, it's like, we don't care about a good idea. Who in the room has the good idea, as long as you have the good idea? She seems to be very much one of those people.
We say far reaching, and talking about the nurturing of young talent there, is there any kind of surprising names that sort of came up, like who was kind of who Deborah had reached out to or who had a massive influence on that surprised you?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of ones. I think James Cameron was one of those sort of names where it was like, whoa, the James Cameron? Mm-hmm. You know, she kind of utilized his talent before, you know, I think he was working for Roger Corman at the time. But, you know, aside from that, like, kind of nobody had seen. And, you know, that kind of led on to Gail Ann Hurd, you know, which was a great one. Hopefully we'll be speaking to her soon. And her, you know, her story is amazing because the Terminator has nothing to do with Halloween. I mean, it is almost, you know, a slasher movie, and that, you know, an unstoppable force is trying to get to this woman. However, you know, Gail and James Cameron kind of said, well, Deborah has proven that they can do it with Halloween, so let's do that. You know, let's just do what they did. Let's just keep it low rent and dry. And apparently, when Gail was getting ready to prep Aliens, she was, you know, not thought of as a producer at all by any circles within 20th Century Fox, and was just being completely dismissed. And she phoned Deborah and was just like, look, what do I do? You know, what do I do in this situation? And Deborah was like, you need to show them that you can do it. And you can't, I know that you can do it. So just, you know, go and be yourself, go and be strong. And, you know, that movie got off the ground and is so incredible. And then it kind of established Gail Ann Hurd as being this absolutely force producer, which again gave us so many movies kind of throughout the years. And that's kind of what I like to say about Deborah, is that it's, there's a ripple effect in her life because she's touched one person, that person's then touched, you know, a lot of people. And, you know, one of the other, I mean, I probably the most lovely story of filmmaking that we've heard so far is a film called Ciao Bella, which Deborah produced. And, you know, Deborah produced this 98, I believe. And it was right around the time when they were doing Escape from L.A. And it was Brian Grazier's brother who had written this script, and Deborah knew him as a driver and was like, well, you should do this. And he was like, oh, I don't have any money. And she's like, I can get you some money. And, like, you know, we'll do this at the weekends and, you know, it'll be great fun. And she would basically, like, take people from Escape from L.A. and, like, resources, like trailer and stuff from Escape from L.A. and give it to him. It's like, right, cool. Now, you go make your movie at the weekends and whatever. And it just shows you that, like, this incredible, formidable producer who was so highly regarded and making big blockbusters kind of said, do you know what, for the love of cinema, I'm going to go right back, you know, to 1978 and make a no-budget feature film. And it's just stories like that where you kind of go, wow, this woman was really a cut above the rest.
Any stories that stick out for you, Margaret, in this production process and finding out more about Deborah Hill?
I think Ciao Bella is actually one of my favorites because I was speaking with the director and it was made for $50,000. And so because Deborah was, like, she was shooting at the time, she execced it. And Stephen Nemeth, who we've also spoken to, was a bit of a hilarious Zoom interview. He produced Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So, you know, very established producer in his own right as well. And I also, you know, had ties separate to Deborah. Like, they both work with Terry Gilliam. So there's always like a little, there's a spider web almost. But he produced that. But they shot that on weekend for, yeah, $50,000. They just kind of, it was a bit of a beg, borrow, steal production. But I kind of love that as an indie filmmaker, that when they were making these big studio productions, they still went to the grassroots because they thought, yeah, okay, we've got a bit of money that needs to be spent. How can we best spend it? And we all know that Hollywood accounting could have made that money disappear very easily. And they were like, yeah, let's make a movie. So I think it's just things like that. You know, we've been speaking to, yeah, just a lot of filmmakers that she worked with. And, you know, obviously Gail has been a big proponent for, she's really a strong, such a strong voice for trying to keep Deborah's memory alive. She really considers her, you know, not just a friend, but a mentor. And you'll hear her talk about it over the years. Jamie, I remember Jamie was telling us about when Deborah was going to pitch Clue. I think they were just hanging out. They were hanging out in Deborah's apartment, I think it was.
Yeah.
And she basically said that she had a meeting to pitch this game. And Jamie was just like, a game? What? So you think about it these days, like, it's all about IP. You know, what game, you know, what game are we going to adapt? What book are we going to adapt? Play, whatever. And she was one of the first ones who sort of went, yeah, okay, well, I think this board game of all things as well, you know, this could be a movie. So yeah, it was just, I think it's all those little stories that kind of just show her insight. You know, she was interested in Marvel before it was Marvel, you know, things like that. Like, there was just so many, she was on the pulse in so many ways. And actually, as filmmakers, it's really cool to kind of look at someone like Deborah and go, okay, not only don't forget your creative roots, but also, you know, trust those gut instincts, because more than often it's going to be right.
Make sure to check out season one of Talking Shape. Interviews and insights with the actors behind the famous White Mask, including James Jude Courtney from David Gordon Green's trilogy.
Certainly there are people, you know, stunt guys who have played various roles and just put on a mask, but they don't sell that well. The basic studio exec, legal, business affairs, publicity, Yeah. Just put a mask on a stuntman. Well, that's spoken by men and women who could never do it themselves. who have no concept of what it means to do that. You know, it's like somebody who's never had sex going, oh yeah, 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 all you do is, oh really? Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, why don't you try it one time, motherfucker, and then we'll see what you do.
Brad Lourie from Halloween Resurrection.
He's like the godfather of the whole franchise. You know, I stayed away from him, but I didn't impose on him except for one time I went up to him and I said, you know, Mr. God, I just want to tell you that I'm not a big horror fan, but the only reason I took this job is because I'm such a huge fan of the Halloween series, especially the first one. And he put his hat on my face. He said, it would have been just that much better if you'd been in it. And I thought, what a sweetheart. What a very kind thing. It just made my, it just made my day.
And Chris Durand from Halloween 20 years later.
One of the discussions we had early on was whether or not to have the mask untucked or tucked into the turtleneck. And to me, if the mask is untucked, I want to reach out and lift it up and see who's under the mask. What that means is that there's somebody under the mask. It's tucked in, it blurs the line between it, somebody wearing a mask or him being his own entity. So it kind of gives it that extra little step of he's a little bit of this supernatural entity, not just some guy.
Talking Shape, Season 1. Now available wherever you stream your podcasts.
Now, I'm not sure if you have come across this story or you might have read it in the same New York Times article that I came across. She became a flight attendant and then lingered in Jamaica, getting involved with a jazz musician. This led to her writing liner notes for albums. Now, I'm assuming they're jazz albums, but I mean, I love music, so I'm so curious to find out what liner notes and for albums she was writing for. Has that come up?
Yeah. Well, she wrote a lot of them. The jazz musician you're talking about was a boyfriend of hers, so kind of that's how she got roped into it. But he ended up introducing her to Miles Davis, and she did liner notes for a couple of his albums and all as well. And that's kind of how she got started. So, yeah, you know, she had an amazing career in that respect. And you know, I mean, I think Brian McFadden kind of talks about it in his book, and we spoke to Brian as well, and he said that one of the great things about Deborah is that she probably could have been great at anything. You know, she was a great flight attendant, but just wasn't what she wanted to do. And she was great at writing those liner notes, but kind of said, nah, you know what, I'm kind of done. And again, as indie filmmakers and as people in general, it's really inspiring to hear somebody kind of just say, you know what, I want to do something else, and casting everything aside and kind of saying, I'm just going to dive into this and see how it goes. You know, it's just incredible.
I mentioned earlier about anything exciting or like sort of interesting that sort of really caught your eye or your ear. What about, you mentioned from the top there, Margaret, that the creating a documentary or a film in general is you encounter, I guess, issues in production. Has there been any challenges that you've sort of come across while producing this, and I guess navigating that and essentially making sure that you're respectful portraying the Deborah Hill story? Is anything like that come up?
I think in terms of producing this, the biggest battle, and it's the same one on every single production, has just been finance. It's a really tricky time at the minute to fundraise for documentary in particular. Well, I think the indie market, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's quite recovered from COVID, and it was in a tricky place before that. But in terms of content, I mean, it's a bit like Jim said earlier, I think it's kind of been a testament to Deborah that there's been so many people where we spoke to them and they were just like, this is for Deborah, what do you need? So, you know, people have really been willing to speak to us. We connected with a woman called Barry Evans, who was the VP of Deborah Hill Productions for a while. And we had a Zoom with Barry, and after she'd vetted us to be like, okay, these people are not crazy or just fanboys. And then she emailed, I don't know how many people, actually, I'm really curious to know how many. I think she just done sort of like a big mass email and with our contact information, and suddenly people were just reaching out going, oh, we love Deborah. You know, and it was from people who were either really close friends, the producer who was meant to be, who was gearing up to produce her feature debut as a director, to people that they were like, oh, I only knew Deborah for like a really short stint in my 20s. I did an internship for her, but she basically picked up the phone when she found out what I wanted to do, and it's gave me my career ever since. So there's just been a lot of that.
And look, this is it's a loaded question, and sort of speaking to you, it kind of makes sense. People who either worked with her or knew of her knew the influence and the impact that she did have. Like you mentioned sort of, you know, being John Carpenter's girlfriend and the, you know, I guess people thinking, oh, you know, that's why she's producing Halloween. I think she even was quoted saying the transition over the course of her career from being called sweetheart, darling in the early years to, you know, being, you know, a bit more respectful and calling her ma'am in her later years. The loaded question, do you think because she was a woman at the time and even to this day, she's not seen in even higher regard than she already is? Because, I mean, people who know of Deborah Hill seem to want to make this happen. But do you think just like the overall Hollywood and how, I guess, the movie industry worked back in the 70s and 80s?
I mean, I think that's, yeah, I think that's 100%. You know, it was just a boys' club. In some regards, it is a little bit still. But, you know, Deborah, for getting her foot in, I mean, that was kind of one of the things that is a really standout quality of, you just wasn't, she wasn't for taking no for an answer when she wanted to make something happen. And that's really how she had the career that she did. And I think that why people, you know, really respect her so much. She wasn't a bully.
Mm.
You know, that's the thing. She was just very passionate and very driven. And I think that drive, you probably needed it, you know, in stacks to be pushing through at a time where people didn't want you in the room. So, but that's the thing. If you knew her, people do seem to adore her. But it's just about now is the problem for us. The problem is that not enough people know of her. You know, the whole thing we've said is, you know, her work, everybody knows her work, you know, right through her career, but you don't know her. It's like, so now that's the whole thing with the film right now, is we want to shine a light on her contributions.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with what Margaret's saying. I think that, you know, it was definitely, as Andrea Burloff told us, that, you know, you can count women producers at that time probably on one hand. And there's one of the things we're kind of garnering throughout the documentary is that there's a perception that women needed to be stronger and more fierce and more masculine and so forth. And Deborah kind of undercut that a little bit and kind of said, well, okay, I'm going to lean into my strengths. I'm small and I'm cute and people like me. So I'm going to lean into that as a producer. And that's kind of how she started. And then I think what happened was that kind of lulled people into kind of going, okay, I'm going to help her. And then when they hit a brick wall, they met the forceful, strong, independent Deborah. And as a result, I think she just balanced both sides of those coins perfectly. I think, you know, Tommy Lee Wallace talks about how there was one time on Halloween 3 where something went wrong. And he said, I was angry and I wanted to blame somebody and I wanted to be aggressive and so forth. And Deborah was the one who literally stood in front of him and said, it actually doesn't matter who did this. What matters is that we fix it. And that's kind of Deborah in a nutshell, is that she was this strong, independent, beautiful, incredible woman who, yeah, might sort of bat her eyelids if she knew that that would help the production, which I absolutely love as well, as she kind of played to that trope. But also that she had the guts and the will to kind of back it up and to say, no, this is the way it needs to be. And that's just a testament to how strong it is. And again, it's all about perception. And we spoke to Helen O'Hara, this amazing critic from Empire. And she rightly pointed out about the fact that in old days and so forth, if a man had a angry fit and a breakdown, he would be seen as passionate. If a woman had a sort of breakdown in anger, whatever, it would be like, oh, she's lost control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what was really interesting about Deborah's story is that she always kept her focus and her energy on the pot at the end of the rainbow. and it was always the film that she was gonna do, and she would just do anything, whether that meant donning the Michael Myers overalls for a shot, whether that meant closing down Grand Central Station for Terry Gilliam. She had the strength, the will, and the desire to do that, and I think it's high time that we recognize that, you know, women and men and everybody else, you know, if they have that vision and drive, deserve to be given the opportunity to show it on screen.
And I believe when filming The Kingfisher, Linda Obst and Deborah Hill kind of ran into a bit of an issue with SAG, with the utilization of the New York homeless people, you know, whether that be giving them leftover resources like catering food, or, you know, actually them being paid, you know, to be extras.
That's kind of one of those, instances of Deborah's activism really coming into light, which is something that, you know, we were discovering as the documentary went on. And that story, basically, because there's an awful lot of homeless people in New York, and they were throwing away an awful lot of craft services and so forth, Deborah would say, well, we'll just give it, you know, to these people that need it. And while they're here, they might as well be employed. They might as well be in the movie as extras. And the SAG union kind of said, no, you can't do that. That, you know, that's, you, that needs to go to a registered background actor. So Deborah and Linda Obst kind of just defied it and said, well, fine us if that's what you agree, but we're going to give these people a wage. We're going to give them food and we're going to give them employment for a while. And SAG fined them, and Deborah kind of, you know, clicked her fingers and went, you know, went into the SAG offices and said, and argued the case, and they ended up returning the money, and Deborah donated it to a homeless charity. You know, that's her in a nutshell.
I think a big part of it was Robin Williams as well. He basically went to them and said, you know, I'm being paid a lot of money to play a homeless person, and this doesn't make sense. It just sat wrong, I think, with a few of them. But yeah, basically Deborah was told, you're going to get fined, and she went, okay, fine me. You know, that just, it wasn't phasing her. She just knew what was the right thing to do. So yeah. And then, as Jim said, you know, with craft services, it was kind of one of those things where she just knew that, okay, like, this is, it wasn't even just about feeding to homeless people. It was just the waste of even getting rid of so much food they've spent far too much money on. It's sort of then feeds into the sustainability side of it.
She had a lot of other collaborators, but everyone kind of comes back to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. Would love both your takes. Why were they such a great duo?
Anyone that we've spoke to, you know, we did talk about that. And that was one of the things that when we said to John, we were like, look, we don't want to talk about the fact that she's your girlfriend, or she was your girlfriend. At the very most, the only thing we'd want to talk about is what was it like to work with your partner. And by all accounts, they were a great team who trusted each other. Like, they both knew exactly what the film was that they wanted to make. So they were very, very in sync creatively. And that's what made them such a strong team. It wasn't a director getting his way because his girlfriend was the producer. It was just collaboration.
When you speak to John, and unfortunately we can't speak to Deborah, but one of the things that's very evident is that they were students of cinema and moreover really great stories. Their kind of kinship kind of forming over Hitchcock and so forth, and watching these really, really riveting stories. And I think that's kind of why that they were out to make the same type of movie, which was movies that were, that could be artistic. And I think that, you know, Halloween is an absolute art film, and it's, you know, in its cinematography, in its composition and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's just a really good, simple story, and there's no pretension about it whatsoever. And, you know, I think that's kind of cool that these two collaborators met and said, okay, let's just tell the best story that we can think of. Let's not worry about the loftier meanings or what is the satire behind this and so forth. they were just entertaining filmmakers, and they just sung together really well. And in a case like Halloween, you know, John proved before that with, you know, Assault Precinct 13 and Dark Star, and after in films like, you know, Prince of Darkness and They Live, that he could write, you know, kind of about insidious threat coming in to people. And I think that what Deborah did was to make the people that was affecting very real. You know, Halloween's kind of nothing without the reality of those teenagers and that dialogue that Deborah made, because it makes the threat of Michael Myers so incredibly real. So when you have those two things kind of coexisting in the one project, it gives you something that, you know, unfortunately a lot of films, in my opinion anyway, that came after Halloween, like Friday the 13th and stuff, don't have. You don't have that endearing, you know, central protagonist in Laurie Strode or, you know, things like that. And that's why you kind of get a less effective film. So John and Deborah really worked in sync to make that type of stuff happen. And, you know, it continued on with The Fog, where, you know, Deborah co-wrote that. And John is a fiercely independent filmmaker. And sometimes he maybe just needed a producer who could really, really stretch a dollar. And that's why you get the spectacle of things again, like Escape from New York, which should have been impossible on that budget. But Deborah was able to sort of pull out all the stops and find talent that would work cheap but effectively and present that vision on screen.
And you touched on it there, Jim, with like Deborah basically did the dialogue for the teenagers, you know, like a woman actually writing for girls, and she was drawn on her own experience. I think Jamie Lee Curtis sort of said that Laurie, Annie and Linda kind of represented different parts of Deborah. Margaret, you might be able to sort of speak to this. Male script writers or filmmakers, I guess, writing for females. Not saying that only females should be able to write for female actors or that, but to give it that sort of credibility and realism. Your take on that?
I think it just makes it more natural, and that in itself, and as a viewer, you probably don't question it when it's natural. You know, you just accept because it just flows. I remember watching a movie, I'm not going to name which, but I watched a movie, it was last year, and I came away after and I was like, this writer-director cannot write women, because the dialogue was just so cringe, and it really, like, I noticed it. And I think that's it, when you notice how bad and when it takes you out of the film, that says it all. And I don't think that's the case across the board, you know, as in, I don't think it's, you know, it's so binary that it's like a gender thing. But when men were the dominant creative voices for so long, you will see that a certain style is what comes through more. And for Deborah's input to shape those characters, their voices and their dialogue so much, it does help it stand out quite a bit. You know, they're not just based on Deborah, they're based on people in her life. So there's a lot of truth coming through. But I suppose that's, you know, that's kind of the coin of a good writer. It's also using what you know. It's not just it's not about, you don't have to tell a story that you know, but how do you inject maybe like some of yourself and your world into it? And I think that's what she did really well. And that's what makes it much more grounded. But, you know, and as we know, is what makes it so much more scary. Because when it feels real, that's when the fear really comes through. And that's why Halloween has had the impact that other movies that tried to replicate didn't. You know, they've thought it's about a masked man and with a weapon, and it's not. It's about the people that fight back. And even the fact that, you know, that Laurie fights back, she doesn't, it's not a case of someone's just running away. Will they get caught? You know, are they a feeble character? There's strength in the fighting, whether you win or not. So I think just all those elements just helped elevate those characters a lot more.
I've said this about John Carpenter before, but I think it's the same with Deborah Hill. A working class style, like, and I think when you're an indie filmmaker, you know, like you said, her donning the overalls or all that. And I kind of imagine that sort of came from her background, her upbringing. Has there been any sort of insight to her growing up, her influences, and I guess that working class style?
Yeah, a little bit. Bob, again, when we interviewed him, Bob, you know, he told us that they came from a very creative family. You know, whether that, you know, Bob's a really great musician, you know, and I think their parents were kind of a perfect mix of hardworking grassroots, you know, we need to travel here to make, to get this job done. We need to do this to get this job done. But also the other half was very, very encouraging to say, yeah, you know what, go take a chance. You know, go and pursue your passions. And, you know, if you fall on your ass, as Bob kind of tearfully said in his interview, you can always come home. You know, they had that very, very strong sort of support network. And I think that's kind of akin to what Deborah needed to do to make, you know, for, because, you know, Halloween for being $320,000, even in a digital age, that is incredible to think that they pulled a film like that off so effectively. But, you know, her upbringing and her sort of working class attitude and her sort of drive that she had just made her be able to say, okay, if we cut out this, we can have this. If we, you know, let's strip it back to the bare essentials. And Jamie told us a really funny story where people would come in with like their receipts for you know, things that they had bought, and she'd be like, well, hold on, you bought 3 rolls of gaffer tape, how many did you use? And the person would be like, oh, 1. Like, oh, well, do you need to buy 3 again then? You could just buy 1, or better still, what if we left those 2 back? Could we get a refund? You know, it's that sort of attitude that, you know, might seem meticulous and might seem, you know, penny pinching, but it's the, that's why you trust her with your micro budgets, because you know it's going to end up on the screen.
It was funny because like the receipt story is actually one that we've been told from different productions. That wasn't something that left Deborah. She really went through, like she itemized everything. So she knew exactly, you know, full run of the spectrum when it came to the film. But on Halloween as well, like because they had so little money, they would sweep up the leaves from the street and take it round the corner to dress a new house because they couldn't afford the dressing. I mean, that in itself, it's like, you don't get more indie grassroots than that. But yeah, Bob also told us, I mean, I think like their parents, it was just a case of their parents had to work. So I think him and Deborah were just sent to the cinema every day. I think, and the only thing that was on was it Gone with the Wind? I think they watched Gone with the Wind every day for like a month.
One of the things I love about Deborah, she always seemed to be from a small town. You know, she was born in Philadelphia, but then they kind of traveled to these smaller towns around, including Haddonfield, New Jersey. And one of the dreams of my life was always to go to the Halloween locations. And I went to the Myers house, and you know, we went to Laurie's house, and we went to the Elrod house from Halloween 2, and the street where the girls walk home from school. And what's amazing being there physically is that you kind of go, wow, Deborah made an entire town out of a street. You know, like if you, there's certain shots like in Halloween 1 when Laurie emerges right before she meets Tommy when she's walking to school. If you panned the camera a little bit to the right, you'd be in front of the Myers house. But with very clever editing and with, you know, again, a producer who kind of says, right, listen, we have this street. Let's make it work for, let's make an entire town out of this one small patch of land. She did such an amazing job, you know. And again, I think it's being from that grassroots sort of, you know, small town can be, this small town can be an entire world if we let it be. You know, I think that's something that Deborah always brought.
The other thing as well I just throw in is like Deborah, you know, when she first became a producer, it wasn't a case of she just got an in because John was her boyfriend. She worked how many roles across the production, you know, assistant editor, script supervisor. I think like she had worked across the production office as well. So she really had an understanding of every facet of the production wheel. And you know, people are, you know, Jim and I started out with short films, and I'm a big fan of producing your own short, you know, what to like kickstart things, because I think that if you start to understand everything, you're going to have a better appreciation for just how the whole machine works. I think that was something that she had that a lot of people don't. You know, she went in knowing a little bit about every department and what they would require and why they needed something. And she was very much all about the betterment of the film.
Hollywood Trailblazer, the Deborah Hill story. That's the working title at this point in time. Now, when can we see it?
There's nothing concrete in place yet, but we're hoping that it's going to be hitting the festival circuit 2025.
As a filmmaker and producers in your own right, what sort of takeaways, I guess, one, doing this documentary, but then also the Deborah Hill story? What are you guys, when you move forward from this, what are you going to take on board? What are you going to do something differently, or is it going to empower you to try something completely left field? Or what's inspired you?
Oh God, it's tricky that. I mean, I think it's almost maybe just going forward. It's the drive, you know. Deborah just kept pushing. You know, she didn't sort of let things stop her, and I think that's probably it. You know, there's maybe a what in this situation. She'd pick up the phone to that person. Maybe that's gonna be it going forward. You know, she was just. I think one of the things that I admire most about Deborah is that when she was working with collaborators, when she was working on a project, she really did, you know, seem to work by the ethos of what's best. So if a director said they needed something, she understood why the need was. And because she understood the mechanics of filmmaking so well, she could often navigate how to make that happen without costing it a fortune. Like, for example, they closed down Grand Central Station. You know, that wasn't planned. That literally came from a flyaway comment that Terry Gilliam made during a location scout. And then for which he also said, yeah, I know, don't worry, I know we can't do that. And they went, hold on a sec, because we actually think there's something there. So that wasn't a planned cost. And let's be honest, like, you know, not going to be an easy thing to pull off. But yet they managed to do it without spending extra money and going over budget. Deborah managed to find a way to take a day and give a day. You know, so I think that's it. It's just fully understanding it. Not being afraid to say what you don't know, because it's going to better you for the next one. Just keeping that drive for the film going.
I would agree with everything that Margaret said. And the other thing that I would say, you know, being a horror fan, is that I think going on this journey and learning about Deborah is that it really legitimized, you know, horror for me as a genre to be respected. Because, you know, I've always loved horror, but it's always, you know, as John Carpenter says, it's always, you know, one notch above pornography in a lot of people's eyes, and it's not really considered real cinema. And when you see someone like Deborah, you know, who first and foremost defied convention to even make horror, because she was a woman, so surely she should be making romantic comedies or period dramas and so forth, and she was like, no, that's not stories I'm interested in. I like these genre movies. I think that's inspiring, and I would like people to sort of say, you know, don't let yourself be put in a box, you know, tell the stories that you want to tell regardless, you know. And again, just the idea that this woman who you know, came from nothing, made the most successful independent film of all time, and it was a horror film, really kind of legitimized my goals and intentions from whenever I was a small child, because that's what I would love to do. If I made horror films the rest of my life, I would be incredibly happy. And if, you know, Deborah's legacy is founded on horror, then it's still one to be respected. And I think that's great.
What's the, I guess, the call to arms to fans about this? Have I left anything off that you want to get out there about this documentary?
You know, when people see the documentary, I hope they do, you know, but I think when people see the documentary, it'll kind of all be left on the table. I think, you know, our intentions are fairly evident, but they're multifaceted in the way that Deborah was herself. You know, we don't want this to be just a film about, you know, a great back catalogue, and we don't want it to be about a woman in film, and we don't want it to be about a, you know, a an environmentalist and so forth. It's all those things together. And I guess my call to arms with people would be to say, study this woman, you know, especially if you're a beginning producer, because you will learn so much. And if you're a producer who's established, still study this woman, because you'll learn an awful lot of tricks and you'll learn how to be respected and endeared on set rather than feared. And I think that's kind of, you know, the stereotypical image of a producer is the sort of money-grubbing, tight-lipped, overtly male, aggressive, I want this, you know, kind of attitude. And Deborah proved that a legacy can be built on being none of those things. And, you know, that's a call to arms.
Do you know what? Something for me is go and watch her works, because if you're a Halloween fan, you might not have given The Fisher King the time. If you've watched Clue, did you watch Adventures in Babysitting? You know, her final movie was World Trade Center. And when she went to make that, everyone said, you're nuts. This is way too soon. And she literally, she ran into Stacey Scherr on the street and was like, Stacey, oh my God, it's so great to see you. You need to work on this movie with me. And she literally pitched Stacey there and then. And Stacey was one of the ones who said, nuts, it's too soon. And Deborah's ethos was, no, that's exactly what we need to make this. We need to capture, effectively, she was like, we need to capture what's real. Like that's the power of cinema. You know, this woman was such a creative force when it came to storytelling, when it came to reaching the audience. And one of the things for with World Trade Center, for example, which ironically connects very neatly to Halloween, was it's about the people. You know, she didn't want it to be about this big event. She wanted it to be about who are the people, the individuals affected. How do we keep this real? And that's how Andrea Berloff got, an unproduced feature writer, got her shot at writing this, because that's exactly what she pitched. If you haven't seen her works, go and just work through them, because I think they'll probably be pleasantly surprised.
And watch The Dead Zone. It's a masterpiece. It's one of those sort of unsung, total under the radar movies that not a lot of people have seen. But watch The Dead Zone. I think The Dead Zone is one of the most romantic films that's ever been made.
Jim McMurrow, Margaret McGoldrick, the working title as we speak, Hollywood Trailblazer, The Deborah Hill Story. I absolutely can't wait for this to come out, not only as a Halloween fan, but as a John Carpenter fan, but ultimately as a Deborah Hill fan. I'm really looking forward to this. Cannot wait for this to become a reality, and really appreciate your time.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Shape, the ultimate Halloween franchise podcast created by the fans. Make sure to stay up to date with the latest episodes by following Talking Shape on Twitter @talking_shape and liking us on Facebook. Feel free to give us a review on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. We appreciate your support. Until next time.
Go home. Go home!